Welcome to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast, where we explore the kind of thinking we need to navigate a positive way forward. I'm your host, Maura Gamble, permaculture educator and global ambassador, filmmaker, eco-villager, food forester, mother, practivist, and all-round lover of thinking, communicating, and acting regeneratively. For a long time, it's been clear to me that to shift trajectory to a thriving one planet way of life, we first need to shift our thinking. The way we perceive ourselves in relation to nature, self, and community is the core. So this is true now more than ever, and even the way change is changing is changing. Unprecedented changes are happening all around us at a rapid pace. So how do we make sense of this? To know which way to turn, to know what action to focus on, so our efforts are worthwhile and nourishing and are working towards resilience, regeneration, and reconnection. What better way to make sense than to join together with others in open, generative conversation? In this podcast, I'll share conversations with my friends and colleagues, people who inspire and challenge me in their ways of thinking, connecting, and acting. These wonderful people are thinkers, doers, activists, scholars, writers, leaders, farmers, educators, people whose work informs permaculture and spark the imagination of what a post-COVID, climate-resilient, socially just future could look like. Their ideas and projects help us to make sense in this changing world, to compost and digest the ideas, and to nurture the fertile ground for new ideas, connections, and actions. Together, we'll open up conversations in the world of permaculture design, regenerative thinking, community action, earth repair, eco-literacy, and much more. I can't wait to share these conversations with you. Over the last three decades of personally making sense of the multiple crises we face, I always return to the practical and positive world of permaculture, with its ethics of earth care, people care, and fair share. I've seen firsthand how adaptable and responsive it can be in all contexts, from urban to rural, from refugee camps to suburbs. It helps people make sense of what's happening around them and to learn accessible design tools to shape their habitat positively and to contribute to cultural and ecological regeneration. This is why I've created the Permaculture Educators Program, to help thousands of people to become permaculture teachers everywhere through an interactive online dual certificate of permaculture design and teaching. We sponsor global perma-youth programs, women's self-help groups in the Global South, and teens in refugee camps. So anyway, this podcast is sponsored by the Permaculture Education Institute and our Permaculture Educators Program. If you'd like to find more about permaculture, I've created a four-part permaculture video series to explain what permaculture is and also how you can make it your livelihood as well as your way of life. We'd love to invite you to join our wonderfully inspiring, friendly and supportive global learning community. So I welcome you to share each of these conversations, and I'd also like to suggest you create a local conversation circle to explore the ideas shared in each show and discuss together how this makes sense in your local community and environment. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I meet and speak with you today, the Gubbi Gubbi people, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. On Sense Making in a Changing World today, I'm joined by Jeff Ebbs, the Brisbane-based author of a new book called Your Life, Your Planet, published by Australian Geographic. He's a long-time environmentalist who's tried his hand at so many different ways of being a changemaker, as a politician, a comedian, a lecturer, author, engineer, actor, radio host, and guest. We had such a great chat, and the focus of his latest book is on how building communities can save the world. So come and join the conversation and welcome to the show today. Well, welcome to the show, Jeff. It's absolute delight to have you here. I've just been reading your book, Your Life, Your Planet. And the subtitles is What You Can Do Right Now, Packed with Practical Tips to Immediately Reduce Your Environmental Footprint, and it's published by Australian Geographic. So from this, you know, my guess is that your focus is really around what it is that we can do in our homes and our communities to make a change. But I also noticed that you're an actor, you've stood for for Parliament several times. You stood against Kevin Rudd as well, I saw. Politician,
certainly
academic,
the highlight of my political career.
Activist, writer, so many different elements of this. And I guess the key thread that I see is this key passion to want to bring about change that we need to see in the world. So maybe let's just start at the sort of at this end of the conversation around, well, tell us a little bit about the book and why and how this book came into being and what you're hoping this book will do.
Sure. Well, thanks, Warwick. The relationship with Australian Geographic was initiated by them. So I've worked on a lot of other books written by me or by Tom DeMue, Noom DePlom, Giovanni Abono. So Giovanni Abono was a stage name that I also used to run a radio show in Byron Bay and became fairly well known. So when I first ran for politics, I ran as Giovanni Abono. I had to change my name by deed poll to do that. So that was an interesting little diversion that has had some odd long-term effects on my life and career. But anyway, there was a book called Sydney's Guide to Saving the Planet, written by Giovanni Abono in 2008. Which was tips about reducing your carbon footprint, because at the time the popular knowledge about, you know, what carbon footprint was and what activities we engaged in was fairly limited, and so I thought it was useful to put that together. These days, I think that the challenges have moved on, and what most of us who are sort of endeavouring to help promote a one planet lifestyle, as you appropriately call it, understand that a lot of the issues are behavioural, that there are a lot of things about the systemic nature of society that we as individuals do not have control over. And so while we can do things in our lives to minimise our personal impact, that the challenge is how do we participate or withdraw from those aspects of society that are, you know, fundamentally problematic. So, for example, a lot of us minimise the amount that we fly, but if we are really engaged in the political process and, you know, influencing society at a high level, every now and then we have to jump on a plane to go to a conference or to a meeting or whatever. And so there are clear limits to how much we as individuals can control. And in some ways there's some hope in there, because we can see that systemic change is gradually occurring, and there's also some sort of fear and desperation in there, because just the fact that they're outside our control means that it's difficult. You know, when we have bad governments that won't make decisions, then we feel the train rushing faster towards the cliff and we don't know what to do. And when we look at some of the really wicked problems, like concrete, for example, is something we've really only begun to deal with, yet we fundamentally depend on it to hold the bricks in our home together, the road services that we drive on, and so on. So what I wanted to do was really try and address the issues about how we, ordinary people living in suburban Australia, can grapple with the day-to-day issues that we do have control over in the context that we live in a world that we don't have much control over. And so on one level, the book is 101 tips about living well. Some of them specifically the kinds of tips that you get in any book about reducing your carbon footprint, but some of them are much more behavioural. So, for example, in the section called Garage, which is about transport and the kind of things we keep in our shed, so tools and barbecue implements and those kind of things, one of the tips is just walk. So, you know, we should walk everywhere we can, and if we can't walk there, then maybe we should jump on our bicycle, and if it's inappropriate to ride, then maybe we should drive. And then the question becomes, do we have to drive in our own car, or can we borrow a car or rent one or pay a driver to drive us around? And the answer to that will depend on a lot of things. So, you know, but fundamentally we should walk. We should understand the value of walking. It's good for our physical health. It's good for our mental health. It's good for our relationship with our community. It's good for our relationship with our environment. The sort of things that we learn when we're walking are really valuable in terms of how we place ourselves in our community and how we place ourselves in our environment. And so, to me, that's quite a different approach than just measuring the amount of carbon that we consume or trying to list the kinds of products that we might buy that reduce our impact, you know. So that's a bit of a long rambling answer, but I think it gives you an indication of what I'm trying to do in your life, your planet.
Yeah, and so that I totally agree. I think the attitudinal shift is where it's at, because we can have as many different solutions and tech fixes, but until we actually start to shift the way that we think and interact and connect with our place, then those things can just still sit on the shelf or not really make any difference whatsoever. And there are limitations, as you say, to what you can do at your own home. But thinking about that, you know, everyone's home is also the place where the conditions for change can happen, aren't they? So if you're in a home where there is this kind of shift going on, and then you go out into your workplace, you take that with you, or into your school environment or wherever it is, you take it out into your community. And I think, you know, we need to really value this home-based change, but as well within that context of the broader political framework and also community. Like, community and sharing is something that I've noticed that you talk a lot about, like the importance of community. Mm. Have you noticed there's been a shift in our understanding about the value of community with COVID, do you think?
Oh, certainly. I think, 2020 was the most interesting year you could have possibly chosen to write a book like this, because we were in the midst of seeing those long-term impacts that, something like a pandemic has on society. And the way just that the shelves of supermarkets and shops emptied was extraordinary to watch. People went for toilet paper first, which remains a mystery to me and I'm sure has a Freudian explanation, but nevertheless, that's what happened. And then the basic foodstuffs started to disappear. So sugar, flour, all of those things that people, you know, people of my age grew up with those as being the things that you bought, and a lot of other things you made or grew. And so those were the things you went to the grocers for, those basic foodstuffs. So to see them disappear seemed to me to be a very strong indication that those old-fashioned values were rising to the fore. Then eggs started to disappear, and then things like seedlings and live chickens that people were buying started to disappear. So as the months rolled by, we saw this shifting of society from being a consumer society to having a mixture of consumption and production. And that reminded me of a term that I first heard from a woman called Kat Green, who had written a chapter in a book about the Future of Food, I think the name was, and she used the term turning our homes from being nodes of consumption into being hubs of production. And her argument was that when we stay at home and we do things like knit, make bread, darn our socks, hem our own trousers and skirts and so on, we're not only reducing the amount of things that we consume, but we're actually disengaging from the notion that we go out into society and consume things and then we bring them or purchase things and then we bring them back home and consume them. And what we're starting to do is change that orientation of the individual as the consumer and society as the producer. And to me, that explained a gap that I'd had in my thinking, because I'd always said, grow it if you can, grow it if you can, make your own, whether or not you've grown it, and whatever you do, share it, because that's the way that we will start to transform the nature of consumption. But I'd had real trouble sort of promoting that message. People thought it was sort of twee or quaint or didn't quite see how it related to them. But hearing Kat talk about the hub of production versus the node of consumption, it all snapped into focus. And I saw the power of the home and of doing things at home and of sharing as the basis for building community. If someone pops over to pick up a loaf of bread because you've cooked three loaves of bread because it was just as easy to cook three as it is to cook one, then naturally they will try and give you something in return. So all of a sudden you're setting up a trading network just by baking your own bread.
Simple, really, isn't it? And what's wonderful too is that this is kind of where the work of people like David Holmgren has gone as well, with his retrosuburbia work, basically focusing in on the suburban household as the main point of production, and think about how, you know, education and childcare and food and all of these different things together. So I think it's absolutely fantastic. Where did you first start noticing all of this? When was your sort of moment of awakening around these issues? What fuels your flame?
Well, I was lucky to have grown up with grandparents who were very old-fashioned mixed farmers, and so Mum had grown up on the farm and so was sort of quite rural in nature, and, you know, we grew a lot of food at home. So I had exposure as a child. Then I became immersed in technology and living a very sort of fast inner city high-tech lifestyle as a young person and young parent, young family. So the moment of awakening for me was really the Iraq war over oil, which purported to be over the weapons of mass destruction. So during the time when the planes flew into the World Trade Center, I was living in Sydney and reverse commuting. So I lived in the city and then I commuted out to beautiful northern suburbs, the Northern Beaches, to work at a book publisher's premises, producing and editing books. And so I drove through the city and across the Harbour Bridge every day. And the image of planes flying overhead and the towers of the city was terrifying to me. And for one reason or another, I ended up editing a thing called Energy Daily, which was a newsletter for energy industry executives, people who bought and sold energy. So some of them didn't work in the energy industry, but they were major consumers of energy. And what became immediately obvious to me editing that and looking close up at that industry was that the finance pages of the major newspapers were talking about the challenge of oil prices and our reliance on oil, and fully aware of the implications of fossil fuels on climate change. The international politics pages were describing a sort of geopolitical chess game where the end of cheap energy was the driving force behind the move of Western powers into the Middle East. The environmental pages had similar concerns, but from a different point of view. But on the front page, it was about weapons of mass destruction and how the UN, the chief of the UN arms agency, Hans Blink, I think his name was, couldn't, you know, fight his way out of a wet paper bag, the president of the United States said. And so the nightly news, the front page of the newspaper, the conversation in the streets, the conversation at work was about the smokescreen that was being put out by a small number of vested interests when there was this huge amount of information that was readily available for anyone who cared to look or knew about what was really going on. And so as a journalist who'd been sort of clawing my way up the ladder of journalism, and I got into journalism through technology. So as a technologist who'd been interested in information systems and building information systems, I suddenly realised that it wasn't the grassroots, it wasn't the sharing of information that made the difference. It was who was controlling the puppet strings that really made the difference. And that was shocking to me because, like a lot of us through, I don't know, the peace movement, feminism, the environmental movement, climate change awareness, we all thought that if only we could get the information out there, people would realise that there was a need for change. So when you go back and you look at things like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring or Shoemaker's Small is Beautiful, all those seminal books that really set us on this path of awareness about the dangers of the, you know, industrial consumerist society that we've been building, all of those books were statements about what is really going on. And they revolutionised those of us who were receptive to that message. But none of us were prepared for the backlash. None of us ever assumed that there would be an organised opposition that traded in ignorance and fear to maintain the status quo. Now, in hindsight, how could we have expected anything else? It was a sort of deliberate naivety almost to think that that wasn't going to happen. But I hadn't realised that until I saw what was going on in the mainstream media around the Iraq War, around the 9/11 crashes and, you know, the subsequent war on terror. And so that was my awakening moment. So I left Sydney, moved to northern New South Wales, became involved in community projects, became involved in green politics. I did a lot of different things to learn about public speaking. So I did comedy training courses. I did radio writing for radio courses. I ran the radio program. So I used my magazine skills, my technology skills to sort of frame all of that and do it as well as I could, but I was on a completely different journey. I was then advocating for, but still, I still focused on awareness. And so I didn't really realise until about a decade in politics that politics must be a part of the process of change. But political parties and politicians rarely drive change. Mm-hmm. And so I've stepped back from that active involvement in politics to try and drive change. And I've realised that my best skills are in writing and performing, and so that's the way that I have to do it. And that's also where I hopefully can drive the wedge deepest and have the maximum impact. So I've gone from sort of trying to shine my light where it's darkest to trying to shine my brightest light. If that makes
sense. Yeah, that's a really, really great point. I'm so glad that you said that, because we can often spend a lifetime fighting things in areas where we just can never make shift happen. And yet when we focus on on Shining. And also the thing that I, you know, I wish I was funnier. I'm not a very funny person. I'm always so earnest, you know, and I'd always wish I had the capacity to be a stand-up comic, because I watch as hundreds and thousands of people watch comedians just rip stuff to shreds and get right to the heart of an issue. And if people in the palm of their hands just, and like you said, it drives a wedge. It kind of opens up these doors, these portals for us to see something how we hadn't seen it before and be ready to be confronted, you know. So I don't know. What's your experience of being a comedian in this space?
Well, it's terrifying. And the reason is because you're on your own with a microphone and an audience. You don't have any of the structures that normally carry a performance. You don't have a tune to sing along to or lyrics to repeat. And so it's you in an emotional relationship with someone where you have to drive the relationship. And if you let the audience drive it, you'll completely lose it. And so really good comedians can get an audience that's not responding to their normal performance and regain a connection and a trust with that audience and get them laughing again, and then go back to their the things that they want to do and want to say. And so that's a really, really admirable skill, and, you know, I'm yet to develop that.
But do you think it's part of where we need to be going? Like these different ways of sharing the change, the sharing the ideas, you know, because one way is, you know, I go out and do talks and I run courses and I have a whole lot of different things like that. But different types of ways of communicating. I mean, I guess we need all people doing all different kinds of things, but I really think that this music and the arts and poetry and theatre and comedy all have a really important part to play in helping to shift this awareness.
Look, we certainly need all those forms of communication, because the real challenge is to bring people who are currently disinterested along. And, I mean, that's really where my focus, you know, I think the work you do is brilliant, but only people who want to learn about permaculture are ever going to come to you. I've done a lot of door knocking for various people on just ordinary suburban streets. And, you know, they're the sort of people that Scott Morrison is reaching out to when he says Australians are never going to drive electrical vehicles because they'll lose their weekend. You know, the people who a comment like that resonates with are real, and they're honest, and they're genuine. They're good people. They love nature, but they think experiencing nature is driving through it in a four-wheel drive and zipping over a river with a tinny, you know. Then you stop and kill a couple of fish, and then you've really got your hands involved in nature, you know. So to reach those people requires a different set of skills, and comedy might be one of those. The problem with comedy is that it's not at all empathic. It is rude. It is crude.
Maybe that's why I can't do it. I'm just so nice. Mm. No, I just can't be rude. I don't know how to be rude.
You really have to be prepared to, you know, I mean, writers always talk about killing their own children, because you develop a character that you love dearly, and then it becomes inevitable that the only way the plot can work is when you kill them off.
Again,
that's oversimplifying for the sake of a cheap joke. But, you know, that's what you do in comedy. So you can't afford to be politically correct or sensitive. And so it's quite, in some ways, it's quite destructive. Mm. And so it's a double-edged sword. But certainly it's a useful tool.
Mm. So I'm wondering then, you know, because you have dived into comedy at times. You're a lecturer at Griffith Uni, and you know you've been in the political world. In terms of, you know, doing something like being a lecturer and being in the world of the politics, what are some of your experiences there of where you felt like, oh yeah, this is really helping to make a difference, or maybe what are some of the challenges like really wanting to get to it, like where is it that we can help to get ourselves unstuck?
Well, I think one of the reasons that I keep developing new hats to wear and moving from one career to another is largely because of frustration. So I can talk a lot about what doesn't work in each of those areas. Now, that might be failing on my part that I'm just not good at those things, but partly for the sake of my own ego, I'd like to think that I've actually, you know, identified some of the fundamental challenges. So, you know, I mean, I just talked about the difficulty of comedy being sort of crude and harsh. One of the challenges I found in politics is that you are always promising people that you can do things which are in fact very difficult to do. And so you're asking them to invest their trust in you in a way that you may not be able to deliver. And I found that quite harrowing. The other thing is that the political process sort of chews people up, and the kinds of shenanigans that we're hearing about in Parliament House, but partly just because of the disgusting nature of certain groups of people in our society, but it's also partly because the nature of politics is adversarial, it's about power, and it's completely outcomes focused. So it's never about the journey. You know, the means always, the ends always justify the means. So to me, that's a limitation of politics. What gives me hope about all of those experiences that I've had, though, is that when you are passionate about something and you advocate consistently for it, you do see the change occur. And so in putting a weekly radio show together for a community radio station in Byron Bay, which, you know, has a reasonable sort of footprint. We measured our audience at about 3,500 active listeners a week, which is not to be sneezed at, but it's not the thousands or tens of thousands of audiences that metropolitan radio stations or our right-wing shock jocks get. But what I found was that we were writing original stories based on first sources of news. And what was happening is that maybe 6 weeks later, maybe as close as 3 weeks later, those stories would pop up in the mainstream news. Now, we had very little evidence that we were driving the news agenda, but we occasionally did have evidence in the form of a ABC Radio Perth calling us and saying, where did you source that story? I would like to talk to that person who you quoted. It's things like that. So, and, you know, I mean, what we've seen, the way Fox News has driven the media agenda in America, it's not based on its popularity or its reach. It's just based on its constant advocacy for an extreme point of view. So similarly in politics, if you hold the line and refuse to compromise, the agenda starts to shift. And it's really, really important that we counter that behaviour coming from the Murdochs of the world and the coal lobbies and so on. So even though I personally exhausted myself in certainly in politics, that doesn't mean that it's not worth doing. It just means that I had to move on for my own well-being.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I've often toyed with the idea of standing as well, and I kind of stopped myself before even getting to the point that you got to, knowing that that would be the end for me, knowing, like, feeling that the toxic nature of the culture there and thinking that there's, you know, for someone like me, probably the best thing I could do is to help to do what you were just talking about there, showing up consistently, sharing a different story and inviting people to come and hear that and be part of that other story, and helping to describe what that is, helping to demonstrate what that is, and consistently doing that. I think it's something that you can continue to show up with every day, and to have something that's real and viable, not just ecologically or socially, but also financially as well as a viable alternative. And I think we need other stories that are visible. That
well, one thing that I think that's really heartening is the number of independent, mainly women, who are appearing in federal politics. So starting with the campaign in Indi in northern Victoria, where some community groups decided that the political parties weren't serving their interests. Because they were a safe Conservative seat, they were getting no attention from either party, and so they would run against the parties. And they did it completely from a grassroots approach. They didn't appoint a candidate and then promote them. They went around the community and said, what do you care about? And then when they had an agenda together, these are the things that we want, then they used that basically kitchen table and town hall network that they'd set up to call for people who were prepared to drive that agenda forward, and then they selected their candidate using the same process. Now, Indi has got its second independent. The parties have not managed to break into that.
Wow.
And so now that model is being used by or being promoted by high-profile candidates like, I'm going to mispronounce her name, but Ziggy Stubb or the Olympian, so a high-profile candidate who knocked off Tony Abbott. You know, I mean, that's fantastic. And what we see there is a new model that allows gentle, caring kind of politics to break into that adversarial system. So very small, very early days, but I think that's hopeful in that respect. But what I see most important now is how are we going to learn to, you know, live with each other in communities. So even intentional communities that have common values and set themselves up intentionally to live together and sort out their problems have trouble surviving. So there are a small number of intentional communities that have survived more than one generation. And without trying to analyse the reasons for that, just that statistical fact indicates how difficult that is. When we look at the suburban street, the average suburban street, if you try and get anything to happen in that street, the kinds of arguments that will emerge are extraordinary. So it can be something as positive as a street party or, you know, a Christmas get-together. When it's something more challenging, then the differences between people drag us apart. And even when you work hard to get something nice, like a Christmas get-together, sometimes you find yourself tearing your hair out and going, I really want to put this effort in to sit down and spend Christmas with these people. It's terrifying how hard it is to live with each other.
So
where is the way that
I totally hear. I mean, I live in an eco village, and as much as, you know, great stuff happens, there's also challenges. And fortunately, this is one of the ones where we are here that is seeing another generation coming through, where we've kind of got third generations starting to come through here, which is absolutely fantastic. And I think it's got something to do with the governance structure and the spaciousness of how we live, and I think that helps it. And there's a lot of lessons in that. But so based on what you've just said then, you know, from the writing, from the activists, from the comedy, from politics, from radio, and trying to do something in your own local street, where is it out of all of those experiences that you feel like is the most successful ways where we can start to help to shift this change towards where we need to be in the most rapid and effective ways, because we need to be not just tinkering along, you know, doing step by step now. We really need to be pulling the finger out and doing it in a far more rapid pace than we have ever known possible. I mean, COVID changed a lot of things last year and opened up a lot of possibilities for change in ways that we didn't know that we were capable of.
Yes, the challenge is that how quickly we've gone back to normal. I live in Brisbane and I live within listening distance of a freeway. And so for last year, the hum of the freeway dropped away to you could hear individual cars again. And, you know, within weeks of the Christmas holidays finishing and people having that feeling that COVID was over, it's, you know, it's the same hectic bedlam that it was a year ago. So there has been some kind of permanent shift, but we've eagerly and enthusiastically gone back to normal almost as quickly as possible. So that's just a precautionary comment. I mean, I think that watching the way we behave during COVID tells us a lot about what we can and can't do, and so that's a useful lesson. And I think it shows a real hunger for living more simply and having control over our own time. And I think for me, the convenience and comfort are the drivers of consumerism and everything that consumes resources faster than nature can replenish them. I mean, we fundamentally, we live the lives that royalty lived a couple of centuries ago, and none of us want to give that up. But the reason that only a very few people at the top of the socioeconomic pyramid had those luxuries 100 years ago is because it actually requires quite a lot of resources to create that level of comfort. If you think about the smoothness of the ride we get when we go in a car, and you think about what other forms of transport, I don't know if you've ever ridden around in a cart being pulled by a horse. It doesn't matter how well sprung it is very bouncy and jerky compared to the ride in a modern car. If you were being carried along in, you know, one of those litters carried by four people on poles, I mean, I've never had that experience, but it doesn't look very comfy. And it's certainly not very quick, you know. We can drive a couple of hundred kilometres for lunch if we want to. And as Australians, we do that quite regularly. And, you know, it's not...
So time, you mentioned time then. Like, I mean, this is a really interesting, you know, time is a huge part of this process of change. Like if we're looking at the scale of change, the pace of change, the time that we want to take doing things, like there's so many different dimensions of time in this.
I mean, we have to have the time to sew on our own buttons and mend our own things, whether they're clothes or kettles or toasters. If we don't take the time to do those kinds of things, then we are throwing things away. The only way we can get time to do things like that, well, A, we have to share it around. So specialisation has emerged as a way of allowing us to do the things that we're good at and getting other people to help us. So, yes, we can't do everything. But that means that we have to offer to darn our neighbour's socks so that they can fix our toaster or whatever it is. So some of that requires quite a lot of humility. But the main challenge for us is that we don't have enough time in our life already. And so we have to selectively stop doing things that are time-consuming that don't help. So I say you really have to think about how much time you spend staring at your screen. So a lot of us turned off our television some time ago and don't have a television in our homes. But personally, I've found, I don't know whether it's just a stage of life that I'm at or whether really television has become so good and so compelling that I find myself binge-watching a whole lot of shows in ways that are very similar to the way I used to watch television. So, you know, that's a challenging one. I think spending time in peak hour traffic is a complete and utter waste of our lives, not to mention all of the environmental impacts that peak hour traffic and the road systems that support it have. If you spend the same amount of time on a train, then at least you can work while you're on the train. You can do things. You are not stressed by having to concentrate on this horrible thing that you're doing, sitting in peak hour traffic. So we can make a list of things that are a waste of time and change our lives to reduce the amount of time that we waste. So that's the beginning of it. The other thing is that we, by doing things together, we can, you know, the image of people sitting down to shell peas or, grind grain or whatever, those kind of traditional images of food preparation, those kinds of communal activities where we cooperatively make something, they are multitasking in a completely different sense that we mean when we're driving a car, talking on our telephone and cramming a hamburger into our mouth at the same time. You know, if that's multitasking, then that's not healthy. But when we are sitting around shelling peas or knitting together, we're conversing, we are building community, we are learning from each other, we are sharing our knowledge as well as potentially our output. And so the multiplicative effects of our individual effort is very real. And so we gain time by spending time together in some way.
Mm.
Now, I haven't read the research that justifies that statement, but I'm sure that it's true. So, you know, that goes onto my list of little things that need to be researched and justified. But that's a statement that I'm comfortable enough to make, even though I don't have academic research to back it up.
So you talk about post-growth society. What does that look like to you? I mean, you're describing a bit of that there now. Are there any other, what are the dimensions of a post-growth society?
Well, I think one of the most important things to remember is that Japan hasn't grown economically since about 85. So, you know, that's over 30 years of flat economic non-growth.
Growth, yeah.
Japan is not a failed economy. The Japanese people aren't crawling around, living in caves, eating dirt. When the nuclear disaster caused the Japanese economy to go into a shutdown, the price of the yen increased because Japan had so many overseas assets that the flood of money, I don't even want to try and explain the economics of that because I'm going to get it terribly wrong. But the fact is that Japanese yen increased in value against other currencies because of a disaster at home, because of the nature of the way its investment was structured.
Mm.
Every time that a neoliberal government gets into power in Japan saying that we're going to borrow money, integrate with the world economy, import labour to make the economy grow again, they get chucked out. Japanese people do not want any of those things. Now, whatever you think about the values that implies or the homogenous nature of Japanese society and the possible xenophobia that goes with that, the reality is that you've got a functional modern economy that does not involve economic growth. So it's possible.
Mm.
It would probably involve different things than what we think of. But the mantra that we have and that we hear every day, and you can't open a newspaper or turn on your radio without, I'm showing my age because I'm not the author of those things very often. But, you know, you can't look at your news feed without seeing someone telling you that economic growth is good for you, or you're not consuming, you should consume more to help the economy grow. We want to get people back to work so that they can participate in economic growth. Do we? I mean, really? So we've got to think about what the value is. And, you know, people who are concerned about population growth resist the idea that immigration is what has fueled Australia's economic growth for the last two, three decades, post-war, so the last six decades, not because it's not evident in the statistics, but because it might not be desirable.
So we have many different aspects to this. We need to be thinking about home. We need to be thinking about what's going on in our communities. We need to be thinking about the kinds of work that we're doing. We need to be thinking about where we spend our time and what we give value to, and also to be willing to step up and speak up and be an advocate and to participate in the politics. And that doesn't mean to go into politics, but it needs to be, you know, being part of what's going on in the community, in the broader community, maybe even the bi-regional community, and being a point where people can hear a different story. You know, the fact that, you know, you've got a radio show, for example, that's consistent. You're part of 4ZZZ, a community radio station. There's this other voice that's available to be heard. And so showing up, standing up, speaking up, giving things a go, creating different examples, I think these are all really important aspects of being part of the change. It's not like what is the change, it's like being part of the change process, and that we are in this time of great change. I mean, every era I know is a time of great change, but there's something particular about now. There's a whole lot of things going on, and there's, you know, these looming dates that we have in front of us that create great levels of anxiety. I mean, do you feel that anxiety as you're kind of heading towards the 2030 point, or the, you know, the degrees?
I'm terrified. I have three daughters. They are concerned about whether or not they should have children because of the state of the world. When I was a teenager and in my 20s, the threat of nuclear war caused some of us to think about whether we should have children or not, but it was abstract and distant. And when I hear 25-year-old women now saying, I don't think I will have children, it's not a sort of abstract philosophical discussion for them. It's a visceral decision that they're making with their gut, with their bodies. They're saying this is not a fit place to breed in. You know, I mean, that's terrifying. Not only are we talking about the potential failure of civilization, we're really talking about a sort of potential imminent collapse of ourselves as a species. But to me, there's no point dwelling on that. I could write, you know, significant academic treatises proving that that's the case, but that goes to the sort of, you know, that's a bit like standing on the side of the road with the sign saying the end of the world is nigh. I lived in Sydney. There was a guy who actually did that. He was like the cartoon character with the long beard and the sign saying repent, sinners. It doesn't help. When I talk to Ross Garnaut in a fortnight, my question to him is going to be, you know, you have this grand plan for a post-carbon economic abundance. What are the values that are inherent in that? What are we preserving? Why are we growing? What do we care about and what don't we care about? Because to me, the basic challenge is there are too many of us. You know, the globe might be able to support 10 billion people, but we might have to live in giant mega cities with completely unpopulated landscapes where robots grow food for us to do that. And I'm not sure that I want to live in that world. I do want to be able to go and pick leaves off a plant and eat them. You know, I do want to understand and have a relationship with my food. Now, I don't go out and hunt meat. I don't keep an animal and milk it. But I do have a whole lot of green leaves that grow well in subtropical Brisbane, and I haven't bought spinach or silver beet for 3 or 4 years, you know, so because that makes sense to me. And so we have to be a bit kind to ourselves too. We can't put on this sort of morally strict hat of I have to do this list of things because that's the only way the planet can survive, because we can't sustain that. That takes too much moral fight. That's fanatic. You know, that's fanatical behaviour. And even though I've been driven to be overly earnest as a politician and overly fanatical in quite a lot of the prescriptive kind of things that I've come up with, I haven't been able to maintain them in my own life. And what I've realised is that's because they're too harsh. So we can't. I don't think we can be fundamentalist about it. We have to nurture ourselves. We have to nurture our family. We have to nurture our neighbours. So it's through that, what I can do at home, how can I best build that, that we are going to get through this. Because when it comes down to it, things can collapse on Wall Street and it won't affect our day-to-day lives too much. Once things like the internet start to fall apart, though, then we are going to start to suffer. And so we do need to work at a systemic level as well. And so we each need to work out what we can do in our homes, in our streets, but we also need to work out how we can best use our influence at a macro level. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's a combination of what we do at home and what we do in the world that is going to make the difference. And we each have to come to that conclusion for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Bob Brown used to say, each of us can only do one thing, and if that's saving the blue-throated thrush, then save the blue-throated thrush. If the person who's saving the blue-throated thrush asks for your support, work out whether you can afford to help them or not, because your mission is to save the red-backed nuga doggy or whatever it might be, you know. And I think that's a really important thing to remember.
Yeah. And then that reminds us too that we're all in it together, that, you know, one planet living requires us to be passionate and focused on what it is that what we can do, where we're at with the passion that we have for that, but not to be blinkered though, to see,
and not to try and do the same thing, so not to be not to preach to each other.
So much food for thought. Jeff, where can people find out more information about your book or any other work? Is there anything, any other websites that you'd like to let people know about where they can follow up?
Well, I think my focus at the moment is largely on the book and my university work, which is not public. But yourlifeyourplanet.com will get you to the site about the book. I abbreviate that to YLYP, so you can use that as a hashtag and so on, and that will get you somewhere on a few of the socials. And so, yeah, hashtag YLYP or yourlifeyourplanet.com.
Fantastic. So I'll put those down in the show notes for anyone who's listening to be able to follow those up. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute delight to spend this hour with you and explore all the different aspects of how we can actually make sense of what's going on and to bring change in the ways that we're able to. So thank you again, Jeff.
Oh, thanks for your open-ended questions, Morag. It's been, you know, very, it's stretched my mind to have this conversation as well. So thank you.
Wonderful. All right. Well, take care and hope to catch up with you again soon.
Excellent. Bye for now. Bye.
So that's all for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Head on over to my YouTube channel, the link's below, and then you'll be able to watch this conversation, but also make sure that you subscribe, because that way you'll be notified of all new films that come out, and also you'll get notified of all the new interviews and conversations that come out. So thanks again for joining us. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time.